I'm pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Welcome back, Martin.
It's great to be here, Michael.
Lovely and quiet in Fremantle, Martin. The mayoral elections and council elections are not far away. A little bit of excitement, but really a little bit of rain, a little bit of wind, a little bit of sun. Spring is in the air. And we can sort of ignore the rest of the world if we want to, Martin. But how could you possibly avoid seeing, hearing, even occasionally thinking about Donald Trump being in London with the King? Have you been watching all the splendor?
I've caught a bit of the pageantry, and the British monarchy does pageantry well. That's their shtick. And Donald Trump loves pageantry. I think some of us suspect that he wouldn't mind being a monarch. And so that was a kind of match made in heaven in a way. So you had the king in all of his finery, and you had the penguin suit on the president, and all of their entourages, etc. And he looked like a pig in mud. He was very happy chappy, which was, and I think that probably helps a lot with in the UK in terms of those connections, because they've been trying to build a bit of a partnership with the Trump administration to try and advance Europe's interests, and they're probably doing a little bit better at it than say France and Germany and other countries.
Well, that really becomes the next question. One's left thinking that Trump really does want to be there just to be with the king, but somebody has said to him, look, well, that's not the way these things work. You have to do other things. You have to invite an entourage of tech giants and other people, and you have to get a commitment from Melania that you'll wear one of those big, amazing hats again. But what is in it for the UK government? Is he trying Trump trying to wedge something between the continent, the Europeans, and the UK, and draw the UK into the US's orbit?
I think that certainly there's that intention. There's something about, I think it's it might have Scottish background. There's
He
something about
does, he does.
there is a still a romanticism, I think, amongst some US conservatives for Britain as the colonial power in a kind of way. And the English speaking, look and sound a bit like themselves, etc. So there's a cultural affinity amongst some US conservatives for Britain that doesn't exist for other countries in quite the same way. So I think that's all part of it as well.
Well, we didn't hear or see John Lyon popping up at Buckingham Palace or at any of the state banquets or wandering in the garden with Melania and Princess Kate, but there was a little bit of a contretemps, if I can put it that way, Martin, between Trump and our ABC journalists doing a Four Corners episode in the garden at the White House before the president rushed away and did what presidents do, climbed up into a helicopter. I must say, on reflection, I think a lot has been made about nothing, but there's plenty of people to disagree with me, probably you too.
Look, the very impertinent John Lyons dared to ask about Donald Trump's business interests and got short shrift from the president. And then, of course, the part that everyone's ears perked up was around that he was hurting Australia because the Australians are trying to become friends with us. Donald Trump said, you know what's really interesting is you get in these exchanges. More information that you get through the official channels. So actually, he kind of confirmed that the two of them would be meeting. And that has not actually been officially confirmed in other channels. So that was really quite funny. But look, I think that's just a robust discussion. I don't think there will be any material all out for Australia in that. There might be a bit for the ABC. Donald Trump's known for run-ins with journalists. He picks his favorites. There's others he doesn't like. He wouldn't be the first US president to have that view, and certainly not the first politician to have run-ins with journalists. If that did materially disadvantage our relationship, obviously that would be outrageous. I don't think it actually will. I think it's just hyperbole and rhetoric.
Well, I sort of, in a strange way, as I'm intimating, thought Trump handled it all very well. There's this guy, he wasn't expecting a question like that, who asks the question like that. They're out on the lawn. and he takes it in his stride. And yes, and as you say, sometimes in the casual impromptu remark, things are revealed. What Trump didn't exactly call for, although he has since, is the sort of banning of late night show hosts on television in the US. We've had this spectacle of the very popular Jimmy Kimmel having his show pulled by his network at the behest of the regulator in the United States. I mean, that really does, in so many ways, seem to spell the practical end of free speech, Martin.
I mean, I don't think there's been a few other journalists of a few other late night hosts that bumped off as well. I think that might have had something to do with poor ratings, the other ones. Generally, you should be allowed to criticize the president and other senior people. There's extra sensitivities, I suspect, because of Charlie Kirk's assassination and whether, you're kind of dancing on someone's graves, etc., around those things. But, even the dead, you should be able to criticize. I would take it as an affront anyone that glorifies political violence. I don't think that's acceptable. I didn't see that he explicitly did that though. His was more around the aftermath of that, and he was accusing Republicans of taking advantage of it, which I think they have actually. When you see the rhetoric going, we're going to go after everyone on the left now, etc. I think there's a poor response. I think what's needed in the US political elite is actually a commitment to work together to speak out against political violence and talk about the things that they might share in common, because it is deeply disheartening to see anyone shot on university campuses, just as we regularly in Australia, I think, Michael, decry all of these mass shootings and gun deaths and gun violence. No one seems to listen sometimes when we're complaining about that.
Well, politicians are famous, of course, for picking on the media at different times, and even in Australia, we've had politicians who haven't been prepared to talk to the ABC or to talk to a particular journalist, or excluding people from their press conferences. It's not unheard of here, Martin.
No, I mean, I think there's been long-standing, even the West Australian. I think it was Jim McGuinty that sort of banned them for his press conferences. For those of us who've been around a little while, Michael, so there's always been a bit of that. And the national level, I think Peter Dutton called the ABC and SBS the hate media, but did he not before the last election? So look, these are not that surprising.
Staying closer to home, Martin, going a little bit north. Once upon a time, Australia was the colonial power, more or less, in charge of Papua and New Guinea. It's no longer like that, Martin. Our PM, Anthony Albanese, the other week went to Vanuatu to sign an agreement, but they're still a bit enchanted with the Chinese up there and haven't yet done it. Then he went to PNG expecting to do the same and seemed to get the same result. All the locals suddenly discovered they had important meetings in their home country and headed off, didn't have their mobile phones with them and missed the meetings, and there wasn't a quorum to sign the agreement. What are you making of it? I think it's actually a big deal myself.
I'd make one word of it. It's called China. I think this is really clear. Now, whether that means the agreement won't be signed at all, I suspect there could be a slight rewording of the agreement or some changes, etc. We know that a special envoy from China arrived just before the arrival of around the time of the arrival of Albanese. And we know that PNG is both a good friend of Australia, but also receives a lot of investment from China. And this was a really significant agreement. This basically said, it's almost as if your armies are one. We can recruit directly into the Australian army from PNG and vice versa. We, joint commitment to defence, a bit like ANZUS, Michael,
Very much like Kansas. They
by
attack you,
PNG.
we'll come and defend you.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that was a big agreement, and I think China didn't like it, and I think the PNG politicians have balked.
Well, I mean, it is fascinating. Many of us grew up with to a bit of a cultural education, and you were supposed to beware of Greeks bearing gifts. It goes back to being tricked into being defeated in a military skirmish. But in this case, you might say beware of China bearing gifts, because they are bearing gifts all around the world, Martin, and I expect we're going to see a lot of countries quite happily accept what they're being offered.
This is going to bear out a lot in the Pacific, where Australia is traditionally seen that area as their backyard. We've had a lot of influence in those areas. Australia and New Zealand have kind of ruled the waters, going back several decades. China now is competing for influence. They know it's pretty easy to throw some money around and then expect those nations to stick up for them in international forums. So it's a clever strategy from China, but it is something Australia needs to be awake to.
Martin, speaking of ruling the waters, it might be what eventually is left, and it's the only thing that you'll be able to rule in the Pacific, the waters, because if climate change keeps happening in the ways predicted, a lot of those small countries are going to be little atolls as the water rises. And of course, this week we've not only had the national assessment on climate change issued, but followed very soon afterwards by the national government, the federal government, accepting the Climate Council's recommendations for what the targets should be in the 30s for emission standards. What did you make of the, not so much the technical side of that, although I invite you to comment on that, but the politics of it?
First of all, the politics of it is about where you might expect. So you've got a 62 to 70% target in only 10 years' time. So it's not far away, and I might come back to that. But in terms of the politics of it, a lot of doubt and skepticism thrown on it by the LNP, the Liberal National Coalition, who are saying, "How are you going to achieve this? Spell that out." And then from the other side on the Greens saying, "You're not being ambitious enough." So I'm not surprised to see that target landed in between those two aspirations. They will need, I don't think it'll be legislated unless the Greens agree to it. I don't think they probably will, but I don't think it needs to be legislated because it's a target. But the question is much beyond the target. The question is how you get there. By their own admission, the government and the Climate Change Authority, whose recommendations formed the government decision. They said basically half of all vehicles on the road in 10 years' time need to be EVs, electric vehicles. Now, to make that happen, people need to be buying new EVs now in large numbers because the cars you buy now are on the road in 10 years' time. So that seems to me to be they would need to make a really sharp turn in terms of the way they have people buying and using cars in order to achieve that. There's a big take up in renewable energy required. Even though there's a battery subsidy system, it's not probably big enough to drive that. So there would need to be significant investment beyond what we're seeing now, I would think, to reach this target.
There's been so much going on in the world, particularly in Europe, in the Middle East, not to mention the politics in the US, that have distracted us from the whole question of climate. But it's good to see it, from my point of view, back on the agenda. And the Shipping News this week posted a story by Monash University and University of Tasmania academics asking the question, is this Australia's climate wake-up call? And then looking at the national assessment, the official report, which they say reveals a hotter, harder future if we don't act now. It's going to be interesting to see. Western Australia, big resource state, doesn't seem to like nailing targets to any wall. They say we'll do things, but don't actually commit themselves, Martin.
We don't have a target in Western Australia. I think most states do. To give you some idea about the change that we would need to make, I believe this is right that the report was saying that we've dropped emissions from 27% from 2005. So that's over 2 decades. We've dropped at 27%. We'd need to drop it 62 to 70% on 2005 numbers in another 10 years. So we'd need to move at least more than twice as fast as we've moved over the last 2 decades. So there's some really significant policy decisions that we need to underpin this. Not so much the target for me, Michael. It's how you get there, and you've got to make your concrete steps to get there.
That's always been the big question, and the politicians don't quite seem to map it out. This report that's come in and the recommendations, Matt Keane spoke to them. He's the chair of the Climate Council, former New South Wales Liberal politician who actually believes in climate change and wants to do something about it. But you have to lay down what you're going to do. I mean, electrification is obviously a huge part of that exercise, and it's not good enough just to say the words, but we'll watch with interest. But saying the words and trying to work out what people actually mean, let me say the words Andrew Hastie. What do they mean in this context, Barton?
Andrew Hastie's comments on ABC Radio recently were really fascinating. They were a line in the sand. This is someone who's regarded as the future leader of the Liberal Party, maybe challenging as soon as the next year or two. And he said he will not wear net zero and he will resign from the front bench in order, were that to be the case. So, as a minimum, there's one senior, potential leadership aspirant that, that Suzanne Ley will get offside if she commits to any net zero target, and someone who would then move to the backbench and may well challenge. So, that was, and I don't think he's alone. Andrew Hastie's alone. I think there are other Liberal MPs that hold similar views. So that, the Liberal Party is particularly torn on this issue. That'll make it hard for them until they've settled it to respond to this target by Labor. But they're going to need to resolve this within their party.
Martin, just looking at Canberra, we're not that far into the new Albanese government. Some of the things that are going to matter during this period of government are starting to come up, the environment, climate change questions. But are there some events that are likely to happen along the way, whether they're by-elections or political issues that are going to be in the Senate, where we see the ructions, the potential ructions in the Liberal National Party coalition tested?
I think that there's going to be people that are deeply unhappy, regardless of what the final policy position is that the Liberal Party takes. And that means resignations from the front bench, possible resignations from the party, dissent when it comes to voting on key issues. But there's a private bill by former Nationals leaders, Barnaby Joyce and Michael McCormack, who both never really liked each other much, but seem to agree on this one thing and have decided they want to stir trouble together. I think that will itself present problems for the Liberal Party if it comes to a vote, because, and if I was Labor, I'd probably bring it to a vote, Michael, for that reason. because it's going to be messy. There'll be people that will cross the floor and vote for this is to dump net zero. It's a private bill to dump net zero. There's a myriad of problems there. You would not want to be in her shoes. I think that she's leading a pretty divided party on climate.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the would-be teals around the place will be thinking right now. If you were interested in being a teal-type candidate, you'd be looking to see who's going to cross the floor in the Liberal National Party and think, oh, go for that seat because there'll be a good number of people unhappy in the community with that attitude.
It will depend, of course, where that electorate is and the nature of sort of sentiments within the electorate. But certainly those MPs that do hold, a Tim Wilson type who won back the seat of Goldstein, that do hold electorates that are sympathetic to climate action. What will he make of this? I suspect someone like him will be put in a really difficult position if the Liberals don't have any ambition on climate.
Martin, talking about ambitions on climate, if you live in Fremantle and you're interested in politics, it seems that a number of people think getting onto the Fremantle City Council is the way to become involved in all sorts of matters, not just filling the potholes that we've got around the city at the moment after all the heavy rains over the last few months, but for example, to be against AUKUS and to be stopping or at least having a lot to say about such topics. Last night in Fremantle, the Australian Submarine Agency came to town and had a public meeting in the Fremantle Town Hall. 200 or 300 people there. I was there. A very well conducted meeting. Top brass, not sure if the Navy called them brass, but they were top naval people, and explained how nobody had anything to worry about. They do this well with nuclear rotating Virginia class submarines coming through and new ones being built. I mean, if you take them at their word, there doesn't seem to be a problem. It seems to be a geopolitical issue. People just don't like the idea of having the Americans and to a lesser extent the Brits coming to town and taking over Fremantle, Martin.
Well, that's true. I think it is probably more an ideological stance that people would have, anti-nuclear stance that people have, and for some people, a desire to move away from the orb of the US, that's driving critique of AUKUS. You and I have talked about AUKUS. I think the main thing I look at is deliverables, and I think there's still some interesting issues to unpack and examine there. One thing, though, that you can't deny is the multi-billion dollar investment that the federal government's announced will deliver really tangible economic benefits for the local area. I think that's got to be undeniable. And with the port moving in Fremantle, I think there's definitely an opportunity there that previously didn't exist.
It was also fascinating to see that their king and our king, Martin, said to Trump, he was standing right next to him, and don't forget, get stuck in on AUKUS with Australia.
That was one of those rare instances where the king is technically the king of Australia too, because he's our head of state as well. Well, he mentioned Australia to Trump and said, "You better back in the AUKUS submarine deal."
Well,
So,
I'm sure Keir Starmer was sitting there thinking to himself as the King was going on and on, holding his program notes in front of him. I hope he's not put a line through that.
now you mentioned it gave that a it seems that the word on the street is that US is recommitting to AUKUS. I think there's still, like I said, all of those issues around submarine production and how fast that's going and whether Australia is really scheduled in a suitably timely fashion for the construction of the first submarines. But at least in principle, it seems that that's on again from the US perspective.
One of the first questions last night in the 45-minute question time was more or less, are we on track? And a very confident, yes, we are. I've actually got Australian naval variety of people off in the US learning how to be nuclear submarine maintainers and, which end of a radioactive isotope is the right end to bounce around, all that sort of stuff. Well, an interesting note, and we're going to hear a lot more of it here. But we've also got the Fremantle elections coming on. I've mentioned that a couple of times. Five mayoral candidates, a little bit of action around the place, Martin. People ask me who's going to win. I say, well, I don't really know because we don't have opinion polls. We don't have things. If you go and count the number of placards people have put up and down and around Frio and its suburbs, maybe that's a way of trying to gauge it. But have you got any idea?
I'm not certainly not predicting it at the moment, Michael. I think it'll be a tight race. I think it'll be a really interesting race with that many candidates. We've also got optional preferential voting, so those candidates that are unsuccessful can preference other candidates. All of that makes for an interesting race. We may well not know on the night, particularly if it's tight, and we might need to wait a little while those preferences are counted.
The other thing I should just mention to local Fremantle listeners is expect the postal voting envelopes to arrive in the mail, if not today, certainly early next week. I think your biggest challenge is going to be to find a living post box to drop them in these days. They seem to have disappeared. You might have to go into PO Central in Frio and pop it in the letterbox. But it'll be interesting to hear, to see what happens, because the postal votes these days are the huge part of the election, Martin.
They are one thing that worries me a little bit about the postal voting process is whether young people still are keen to use postal voting and do so because they're already underrepresented. In general elections at state and federal level, and that's probably exacerbated through using a predominantly postal voting exercise here.
I thought you were going to say it'd be a question whether they know how to write, Martin. Do your universities
No, I'm a
really
big
know how
advocate
to
for
write?
young people, Michael. I think they're clever. I think they're switched on. I just don't think they use the post that often.
Well, we don't trust sort of voting by a computer yet. So we'll wait and see what the outcome of the Fremantle elections are, and we'll know towards the end of October, the 18th of October, in fact. Martin, it's been lovely as always talking with you about these variety of the issues, and look forward, you and I, I'm sure, to be invited to a big state dinner at Buckingham Palace next time we're in London.
I'm just waiting for my invite in the mail, Michael.
Yes. Well, keep waiting. See you next week.